This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Deepening Crisis of Global Capitalism. We are sad to announce to our devoted Taking Aim listeners around the world that this will be our final broadcast on WBAI. We are concluding our ninth year of producing and broadcasting Taking Aim, apart from specials and multiple hours of fundraising and providing premiums.
On Sunday, October 31st, we received the telephone call from WBAI Interim Program Director Tony Bates informing us that Taking Aim would be moved from Tuesday 5 p.m. to 10 p.m., the bedtime hour. Neither we nor you were consulted about this change, nor was our input sought on how programming on WBAI could be improved and its listenership expanded. The methods are those of any corporate capitalist management.
This, along with other actions by the current WBAI and Pacifica management, led us to reevaluate our association with WBAI. Our decision was a difficult one, since so many of you have told us how much you appreciate and rely upon our perspective and political analysis.
Rest assured that we shall communicate in small ways and large as we pursue the many other projects in which we are involved. We shall maintain our connection to our audience and to all those who share our political vision.
We ask you, our Taking Aim listeners and supporters, to keep in touch with us at takingaim@pacbell.net and to continue to visit our website and program archive at takingaimradio.com. Now on to our program. First, we have an update with Ralph Poynter on the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Ralph is on the bus in Philadelphia to the last appellate hearing for Mumia Abu-Jamal. His life is on the line. Ralph, welcome to the last program of Taking Aim.
Thank you, Maya. I'm saddened to hear that, but we will continue.
Politics.
Ralph, I can hear the voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal in the background. Can you tell us what is happening today in Philadelphia?
Everything has stopped everywhere for people of the movement to go and support Mumia, for those who are arguing on his behalf to avoid the death penalty. That's what he's facing today. Death penalty or a life sentence. We're looking to avoid the death penalty and then to continue fighting his life sentence afterward. People from all over the country are gathering to be in front of the courthouse to let people know that it is not just the attorneys and it is not just the people in the court, that we're having a large demonstration outside. I had hoped to get into the court, but a very few people can get in, so I will participate on any level that I can support Mumia.
Lynn has always made it clear that at this moment, the defense of Mumia is the utmost priority.
She says they're trying to keep me in jail for life, and they are trying to take Mumia's life. So every ounce of energy, funds that you have must go to Mumia because he represents all of us who are political prisoners. He is so wonderful, so articulate at spelling out what the situation is. And I fear for Lynn because I think, Maya, your interview with Lynn that's gone out has raised some eyebrows. And now they're slowing down and stopping her mail, her political statements that have gone out of the prison. Of course, she's in a federal lockup. She's been charged with terrorism as opposed to Mumia's charges, but it comes from the same root, these evil political or legal, extra-legal activities against all of us who seek freedom.
That's right. The attempt is to silence those who speak out and struggle against oppression.
Very clearly stated.
Thank you so much for joining us each and every week for our update on the case of Lynn Stewart. As you know, we will continue to struggle and be with you and Lynn.
Thanks, Ralph.
Thank you so much.
And now, the deepening crisis of global capitalism. Two headlines. This has been a record year of bank profits. Bank profits have been restored to the pre-crisis, that's the 2008, level. Not only bank profits, the pay of the average Wall Street worker has boomed 25% since 2008. The average worker took home a $124,000 bonus last year. In Morgan Stanley, the investment house, it was a $253,000 average bonus. At Goldman Sachs, it was a $461,000 average bonus. Now, remember, that's the average. But compare that to the announcement that took place at the recent meeting of the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and the International Labor Organization, the ILO. It took place in Norway just a little while ago. Laszlo Andor, the European Commissioner for Employment and Social Affairs, told the conference that 2010 had been, quote, an annus horribilis. That is Latin for a horrible year. And this was a horrible year for unemployment. Quote, but if we fail to act, he warned, 2011 may still turn out to be the annus horribilis for social cohesion. What did he mean? His fear was that mass joblessness could bring a mass upsurge of class struggles and political crises, as we have seen in France and in Spain and in Greece. What shall we see here in the United States?
Well,
Ralph?
What Laszlo Andor and the captains of capital are frightened about and are preparing to address are the 210 million workers who are jobless globally, which is the highest level in recorded history, a 34 million rise in the past 3 years. 80% of the world's population has no social welfare of any kind. Over 1.2 billion people, or 40% of the world's labor force, do not earn enough to keep themselves or their families above the $2 a day poverty level. And what particularly frightens Andor and the top officials of the IMF was that the much increased joblessness in the advanced economies of Europe and the U.S., the U.S. official number of unemployed has risen to more than 15 million. Half of those are long-term unemployed. It's a level not seen since the Great Depression.
Ralph, 25 million jobs have been eliminated since 2007 in just the advanced industrial countries. These are the countries that participate in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. They released a study that 10 million jobs alone will likely be lost among the member states by the end of 2010. And think about what this means. This is the 30-member group of industrialized countries, the most industrialized countries. This is not the poverty-stricken countries or the underdeveloped countries.
Overexploited countries.
The overexploited countries. Among Spain has the highest unemployment rate, 18.1%. But it is also joined by Ireland and the United States.
Well, the IMF chief Dominique Strauss-Kahn told the gathering that the global financial crisis has left a wasteland of unemployment, that having a job was a matter of life and death, and she warned that rising unemployment will lead to violent conflict. The featured speakers at the IMF event were the Spanish Prime Minister José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero and Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou, whose governments have already been confronted by strikes and mass resistance against the IMF-dictated austerity. In fact, Zapatero warned that long periods of high unemployment will, quote, set off a crisis of pessimism and lack of confidence in government and established order across Europe. The ruling classes in Europe and internationally are extremely and acutely conscious of the political tensions that have been generated by the radically declining living standards. Hostility to the established ruling parties has been expressed in elections in Britain, Australia, and Sweden, hung parliaments. In the U.S., the Democratic Party's collapse in the midterm congressional elections is an expression of the resistance of people. The the disillusionment and the pretenses of the fakers like Barack Obama, which we will be addressing in the course of this program.
For the first time in history, Ralph, more than 1 billion people, or nearly 1 in 6 inhabitants of the planet, are going hungry. And this is according to the United Nations World Food Program, the WFP. The chronic poverty, there's still high food prices, but the impact of the capitalist crisis have led to the sharp number of hungry people. This number of people, 1 billion, is larger than the combined populations of the United States, Canada, and the European Union. The number of hungry people shot up nearly 200 million over the last decade. 200 million. This is supposed to be an era of wealth. But the shortage of food is not the problem. We have enough food in the world, according to the World Food Program, sufficient to feed the world's population. There is no food shortage. 65% of the world's hungry live in 6 countries. India and China, notably, countries who were considered the uprising industrialized countries, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Bangladesh, Indonesia, Pakistan, and Ethiopia.
Well, Maya, over 1 billion people, 1/6 of human population, have experienced undernourishment. The 2 United Nations agencies reported the ranks of the hungry have increased by 100 million people in 1 year. As you say, it is the most severe economic crisis since the Great Depression, but that doesn't begin to indicate the magnitude of pauperization and immiseration which is sweeping the planet. The world's poor are suffering from the effects of the commodity speculation that sent prices of staple foods, rice, wheat, and corn, beyond the reach of billions of people. Prices have receded, and now, on the average, been 17% higher than the last recorded price increase. High food prices are causing more than hunger. Difficulty in procuring food is forcing families to adopt what the IMF calls coping mechanisms, replacing, quote, more nutritious food with less nutritious food, like sawdust, selling productive assets, foregoing health, education. These figures underestimate the nutritional crisis in the advanced countries, so-called. In the United States alone, 36.2 million people live in households defined as facing, quote, food insecurity. How's that for a euphemism? This is before the onset of the economic crisis, including 12 million children, according to statistical analysis of the Department of Agriculture in the U.S. and the Census Bureau data. See, the U.S. Children face 12 million children face hunger and food insecurity by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They underestimate because they undercount. But the realities are that the state of food insecurity, as it's called, is affecting the entire population of the planet.
Ralph, there's a website, livescience.com, that gives statistics about the impact of lack of food, of malnutrition. The most common form of malnutrition is iron deficiency, and this is affecting billions of people worldwide, even those with access to food. Iron deficiency impedes brain development. Another deficiency that impedes brain development is the lack of iodine in pregnant women. Deficient mothers lead to mental impairments in their babies when there is lack of iodine. And iodine deficiency affects 780 million people worldwide. Zinc deficiency results in the deaths of 800,000 children each year and weakens the immune system of those who survive. Let's look at other deficiencies. Vitamin A deficiency affects 140 million preschool children in 118 countries and is the leading cause of child blindness. It kills 1 million infants a year, according to UNICEF. Ralph?
Well, the new reports on unemployment, poverty, and hunger that were released by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in September reports that by the end of 2010, another 10 million jobs will be lost among member states, bringing to 25 million the number of jobs that have been eliminated. The OECD unemployment rate has climbed drastically. It's the highest on record dating back to World War II. The unofficial employment in the U.S. stands at 9.7%, but it is a drastic underestimate, as the OECD is obliged to concede. What they call the trend towards impoverishment among young workers has escalated. People who are young are losing ground financially at an unprecedented rate. The jobs and pay benefits and social spending that is being eliminated has condemned vast numbers of people in the United States to a future of increasing immiseration. The economic crisis is ravaging workers in the so-called developing nations. One out of six is facing starvation globally. That's over a billion people. Hunger is so widespread that it is engulfing sub-Saharan Africa and Asia. It is growing among workers in the capitalist countries of Europe and the United States as well. The World Bank predicts that the economic crisis will force over 90 million more people into poverty by the end of the year. Governments of so-called developing nations are responding to the economic crisis by slashing all social spending on education, on infrastructure, on health care. One out of three is on food stamps in the United States, and it's rapidly approaching one out of two. Secretary General Angel Gurria of OECD has noted that the governments have, quote, thrown trillions and trillions at trillions at the banks for the economic crisis. While unemployment is the bottom line of the current crisis, we should not assume that gross domestic product growth will cover this. On the contrary, and the World Food Program Executive Director Josette Sheeran noted that the $3 billion budget shortfall of her agency, which has to bridge that shortfall to feed 108 million people globally, is less than 0.01%. Of the tens of trillions of dollars that have been allocated to the major banks to prop up the financial order.
Ralph, let's look at the United States, the advanced industrial country, the United States, the world global power. 1 million families are losing their homes to foreclosure every year. And as you mentioned, hunger and homelessness are on the rise. USA reported in September that this current recession, the banking crisis, the so-called banking crisis, what we have discussed on Taking Aim over and again, the deepening crisis of global capitalism, has resulted in one in six Americans relying on government assistance to survive. We are not talking about Social Security. We are not talking about Medicare as a support system. We are talking about the over 50 million people who are on Medicaid, the federal state health insurance program for the poor and disabled, which is in the process of being gutted. This is an increase of at least 17% since December 2007. We are talking about the over 40 million people receiving food stamps. This is an increase of nearly 50% since December 2007. We are talking to the close to 10 million people on unemployment benefits, nearly four times the number that were collecting unemployment in 2007. More than 4.4 million people on direct welfare, an 18% jump since December 2007, and there are very few people on direct welfare, as you will recall with Bill Clinton and the welfare to work, the gutting of the welfare system. One in eight on food stamps, one in six in the United States get some form of direct aid, aid that is being gutted by the Obama administration.
And while the vast majority of working people are struggling to survive and sinking into poverty, the rich are doing better than ever. In fact, the disparity between the wealthy, tiny handful of rulers, the banksters, and the corporate capitalist rulers in the United States and the vast majority of the population is expanding unprecedented in its scope and in its rapidity. The stock market has recovered, and executives are awarding themselves with eight-digit compensation packets, which we will be describing. The pay of the population has fallen so drastically that it is barely above the official poverty line for a family of four. $22,000 a year is considered poverty line for a family of four. It's an absurdly low plateau. That means that one person is supposed to survive on $5,000 a year in the United States. Poverty is on a much larger scale than officially acknowledged, because for $22,000 for four people to be considered the threshold of poverty is a farce. It is a vastly greater number in the United States. In fact, the consequence of this is that the White House spokesman of Barack Obama, Robert Gibbs, has assured not just the Republicans, but Wall Street and the banks, that no public funds will be provided for working people, hungry people, unemployed people. There's, quote, only so much that can be done. He went on to assure large capital there will be no use of public funds to hire unemployed workers. He stated on behalf of Barack Obama that the administration's initiatives are aiming to create an environment where the private sector is not simply investing, but benefiting.
Ralph, when you look at the Social Security Administration's figures, it is even more startling. Every 34th wage earner in America in 2008 went all of 2009 without earning a single dollar. I repeat that. One out of every 34 wage earners in 2008, people who worked in 2008, didn't earn a single dollar above board, a reported dollar, in 2009. Total wages, median wages, and average wages all declined. But at the very top, as you mentioned before, salaries grew more than fivefold. More than fivefold, and for top managers, 25% or more. Income inequality is the greatest it has ever been. When you look at poverty, particularly if you look at the rate of child poverty, it is today the same rate that existed nearly five decades ago, 50 years ago, when President Lyndon B. Johnson announced his war on poverty.
Well, keep in mind, as we've emphasized, brothers and sisters, that the initial funds that were handed over to the banksters by Bush and then particularly by Barack Obama was $23.7 trillion, according to Neil Barofsky, the Special Inspector General, and he considered that that was only a beginning estimate. $23.7 trillion, double the GDP, the gross domestic product of the United States. There is no money for jobs, schools, or housing, or relief for the unemployed, or for those who have lost their homes, while U.S. banks and corporations are sitting on cash hoards, literally trillions of dollars now,
Ralph,
again in the hands of the banks, translating themselves into billions of bonuses. Yes,
Ralph,
ma'am.
$1 trillion is being held by corporations as we speak. The lower the interest rate, the more incentive it is for corporations to borrow money at 1%, 2%, and to sit on it. They are not creating jobs as expected in the capitalist theory. No, they are sitting on it, or they are buying companies overseas. It's called, yep, go ahead.
Yes, Maya. Well, the number of people living in poverty in the United States exceeded 44 million in 2009, as you indicate. But keep in mind that these are drastically underestimated figures, because the criterion as to what is poverty, as I've mentioned, is a fraction of the real rate. So you have to take into account, brothers and sisters, that that 44 million may well be nearly double. Because once you allocate a realistic poverty rate, namely the line on which it is minimal to survive in the United States, the number goes through the stratosphere. Reflecting the impact of the slump and mass layoffs and wage cutting and the increase of poverty, which has been concentrated among working-age adults and children, the poverty rate for those 65 and over is increasing. The poverty rate for children rose to over 20% official rate. The poverty increase for all racial and ethnic groups, vastly higher for blacks and Hispanics. The poverty rate for blacks was double. Hispanics, it was double. The white poverty rate went up as well, of course, but it is something like 2.5 times that for African Americans and Hispanics.
I have something startling to tell you, Ralph. Something startling because it has to do with how these figures are prepared, and consequently, the actual rates are much higher. Because families are now doubling up because of economic reasons, several families or unrelated individuals are in a single household. And as the census looks at households, they don't consider, are these people related? Are they unrelated? And so David Johnson, the chief of the Housing and Household Economic Status Division at the U.S. Census Bureau, told the Wall Street Journal that if the poverty status of related subfamilies were determined by only their own income, their poverty rate would be 44.2%. When their poverty status is determined based on resources of all related household members, it's only 17%. So look at the discrepancy between 17% and 44.2%.
Well, even some of the official institutions like the Brookings Institution and the spokesperson Isabel Sawhill has acknowledged that the reality of poverty is that 6.3 million people million people will be added to the ranks of poverty, 10 million more in the foreseeable future, including 6 million children by the middle of this decade. The actual poverty level, she acknowledges, is, quote, far higher than that reported by the Census Bureau. The official poverty threshold she describes, as I mentioned, is ridiculously low. It is not adjusted for geographical location and greatly understates the poverty level in high-cost areas like New York City, Boston, Washington, D.C., and California. And not only that, but the poverty line is so grossly out of date because it is based upon a 50-year-old formula deriving from a period when food was the single largest expense in family budgets, when women did not work outside the home, when young people did not attend college, when the typical family had one car. Totally underestimates the impact of rising costs for health care, education, child care, transportation, and other necessities. There has been a huge increase in the number of individuals and families doubling up for economic reasons, combining families in a single household. So the official poverty rate is a fiction, the fraction of the reality that prepares us for the understanding that this crisis has engulfed our people in the United States. It is only the little beginning of what is occurring in terms of destroying the lives of large and increasing numbers, millions upon millions of people. Brothers and sisters, what we are describing here with the immiseration of the population on a global scale and within the frontiers of the United States is a very real form of violence. Violence against survival, violence against mental and physical well-being, violence against the hope for a better future, violence against the prospects of children, of young people surviving the oppression and the subjugation of their expectations and their survival capacity at the youngest of ages. Violence. Violence that has to be resisted by forms of struggle, which we will begin to describe.
Ralph, as more and more companies are eliminating workers and forcing those who are still on the job to work longer hours at the same pay, or as they are furloughed, usually a 12% cut in pay by giving forced personal days, another thing is taking place. And unfortunately, this is taking place with the collaboration of the labor unions.
The trade union bureaucracy, Maya, the officialdom that is a 13-to-1 income ratio compared to the rank and file who are in bed with the Democratic Party and the corporations and who are basically offering themselves as the transmission belt, what Lenin called the labor lieutenants of capital.
I want to look at one particular example, a major worker fight back, the United Auto Workers. This is an example from a story that came out October 7th. This is the Lake Orion GM plant.
It's a fight back within the UAW of the rank and file that have been targeted for the destruction of their wages and benefits against their sellout leadership. And that's just one little point about this. It's interesting that after Barack Obama, having handed almost $24 trillion to the bank, proceeded to force GM into bankruptcy, the argument that Obama presented was that that would enable them to fire the workers and to force them to take 50% wage cuts. And the New York Times ran an editorial in which it said, as it took Richard Nixon to open the door to relations with China, it required Barack Obama to break the United Auto Workers.
Yes, the United Auto Workers, with the sit-down strikes, with the incredible push to increase the level of pay and the health benefits and the pensions of workers throughout the United States.
The formation of the CIO, the occupation, as you say, of the factories throughout the 30s, the emergence of an industrial working class on an organized scale. That's the legacy of the UAW.
And
that's the magnitude of the meaning of the destruction of this union by the Obama regime.
And the UAW, which instituted and enforced with the large corporations in the auto industry, pattern bargaining so that workers at Ford couldn't be pitted against workers at General Motors. But let's go back to Lake Orion. Lake Orion in Michigan. It is the site of a General Motors plant. It's one of the plants that General Motors was considering closing. And instead, General Motors said it would retool the plant to make the Chevrolet Aveo, a subcompact car currently produced in Korea and Mexico. According to the United Auto Workers, when they walked into a local union meeting Sunday afternoon in Lake Orion, Michigan, and announced that they had agreed to a 50% wage cut for the workers, remember, this is the union bureaucrats agreeing with General Motors officials that the workers would get a 50% wage cut to $14 an hour, 20% below the average wage of a manufacturing worker in the United States, and they would do this for workers with less than 11 years seniority at the General Motors assembly plant in the Detroit suburb. The UAW Local 5960 officials told the shocked workers that they would not be permitted to vote on the wage cut because, quote, general language in the 2009 labor agreement allowed General Motors and the UAW to implement, quote, innovative labor agreement provisions at factories producing small cars.
The members have to be engaged in a fight back. It's a rank-and-file struggle. We started the Million Worker March in 2004, acting in our own name. That struggle is unfolding across the United States and across the world as the rank-and-file begin to fight back against their sellout bureaucratic leadership, no less than the capitalist class that is destroying their lives. Here, in California, unemployment reaches a 70-year high. In the midst of an election in which there is a competition between Brown and Whitman over how far right either of them could go, in which both agreed that they would cut all social spending, and Brown falling over himself to ensure that this would occur, one quarter of the population of California, 23%, is unemployed. 2.5 million represented the August figure. It did not include those who are out of work but have given up looking for a job. Official unemployment is a fraction. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reveals the social reality that lies behind the official claims. And the Brookings Institute and Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke were obliged to acknowledge the magnitude of the increase in unemployment. And in California, it is a special historical significance because it was the symbol of post-war prosperity, California, and indeed a major agriculture producer, home to a significant portion of the country's aerospace technology industry in freefall, a social catastrophe. It's not California alone. In California, the banks and corporations controlled both candidates. In fact, the banks and corporations spent $4 billion nationally on these elections. $4 billion, brothers and sisters. These are not elections. These are referenda amongst the control by financial capital of the agenda, of the program, of the actual intent. The problem that is being addressed here is that both candidates will, quote, cut social spending on a drastic scale. It's not just a question of the right-wing Whitman with her, the former CEO of eBay, who spent a record for personal spending of $140 million, the official number. It's the fact that her opponent, Brown, who has been elected governor, has committed to the drastic austerity measures and the cutting of all social benefits. In fact, the state of California passed a budget for fiscal year 2010 and 11 that includes the most severe austerity measures against the poor and working class ever contemplated. $7.8 billion in spending cuts, $3.8 billion in reduced and deferred payments for education and community colleges, $1.6 billion in payroll and benefit reductions for state employees, $800 million reduction in medical care in prisons, $300 million reduction in in-home support services. Right down the line, brothers and sisters, it is not California alone. We could do a whole program on that.
And, Ralph, these cuts have to be looked at in the context that this is this year's cuts. There were cuts in the years before.
The Illinois Department of Human Services, brothers and sisters, the record number of Illinois families on food stamps, and one half did not even receive them. They are officially supposed to be getting them, but they did not get them. This Associated Press confirms that it is a rapid growth of dependency on working families on food stamps, which they are very, very precarious in receiving. Food stamps, the Christian Science Monitor acknowledges, are costing the government $5.6 billion per month. More and more people are dependent upon them and signing up. These are the realities of the ongoing assault upon the population. Consider this, brothers and sisters. 1 million U.S. public school students are now homeless, a 40% increase. The staggering growth in student homelessness took place simultaneously with the transfer of the trillions to Wall Street and the banks. No part of the country was spared. The NAEHYC and First Focus found that 70% of school districts report a great increase in homelessness. 39% reported enrolling more homeless students in the first 6 months of the 2010 school year than in the entire previous year, the worst affected states, Texas and Iowa, but it has embraced New Mexico with 91% increase, Kansas 88%, New Jersey 84%, New York and South Dakota 73%, Georgia 72% of the 50 states plus the District of Columbia, increases of child homelessness of 50% or more.
Ralph, we need to go back to Jerry Brown in California. Brown stated during the campaign in his 8-page plan for California, quote, "The current pension system costs too much and needs to be changed. We have to be realistic about what the state can afford. We have to review and cut wasteful spending for all state agencies." And that translates to eliminating public employees. He then stated explicitly on pensions that he would raise the age at which people could collect their pension and retire, and he would raise the contributions on the part of the workers. He stated, "When it comes to unions, I'm the only governor who ever vetoed the pay raises for all public employees. I did it once, I did it twice, and I'll do it again."
Maya, shades of Charles Dickens. The American Civil Liberties Union and the Brenner Center for Justice has released reports of the vast increase of debtors' prisons in the United States. In the ACLU report, In for a Penny, The Rise of America's New Debtors' Prisons, in five states, Louisiana, Michigan, Ohio, Georgia, and Washington, debtor prisons are engulfing poor people. California, Texas, Florida, New York, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Arizona, North Carolina, Virginia, Alabama, and Missouri, an even greater increase. In each of the 15 states covering 60%, courts are placing special fees on defendants to generate revenue. These fees differ from other legal financial obligations. Their sole purpose is to put money in the state budget by forcing people into prison because they cannot pay these fees, which are only designed to extract money from people who don't have it. Southern states imprison debtors and are leasing prisoners for employment. In fact, this was a method that was used right after the Civil War to perpetuate slavery, in which prisoners were leased out to plantation owners on a slave basis, the return of the conditions of slavery in reality through debtor prisons on rise across the United States, the untold, shocking reality of the class war that is unfolding in this country.
Ralph, the right to counsel is a basic right. People who don't have money have a right to a public defender. However, in some states, they are charging fees to have this public defender. And so they are finding that people are giving up their right to counsel because they know they cannot pay back the fees that would be accumulated for their own defense. So when we talk about debtor prisons, they're not debtor prisons per se, as existed in Dickens' era in Great Britain or had existed in the United States. The Supreme Court has ruled such prisons illegal. However, in effect, they are debtor prisons because people are being imprisoned because they cannot pay these court or probation
fees. That's what
fees.
The ACLU lawsuit is about. They are debtor prisons by any other name. They are not using the name debtor prisons, but that's the reality and meaning of what is taking place.
Ralph, the premise of the Democratic Party, Barack Obama, and of capitalist economists is if you throw money at the banks, and this is what the Federal Reserve is doing now with its quantitative easing, where it's printing money, just throwing money out, $1 trillion, because it's $600 billion, and then they have a $300 billion of money that is coming back from matured securities, mortgage-backed securities. So they're throwing all this money out into the banking system to lower interest rates with the idea that corporations will borrow and then they'll create jobs, but they don't. And this is what the Wall Street Journal said November 6th. The job market faces a long road to recovery. After losing 8.4 million jobs since December 2007, the economy has only added 874,000 jobs. At the pace in which jobs are being created, it would take 50 months just to replace the lost positions, and it's going to take two decades before the employment is restored to the level it was before the recent crisis.
Well, Maya, the function of the Obama regime, as we did in our long series, False Hope and Short Change, Barack Obama, who was a creation of Archer Daniel Midland's, who funded his political career with the big banks from the onset. Obama announced new tax write-offs for big business at his appearance in Cleveland in late September prior to the election. It was the latest in a series of measures which he had advanced, providing hundreds of billions more to corporate America, doing nothing to address the economic crisis that has left 25 million Americans without full-time work. The administration rejected out of hand any measures to ameliorate the condition of unemployed or the people who are, in fact, part-time workers or who are suffering from the inability to survive through the loss of their homes and foreclosures. The most dramatic expression of this was Obama on 60 Minutes, in which he virtually declared himself a servant of large industry and large business. He acknowledged that he would join with the Republicans now in making permanent the tax cuts of Bush for the rich. He would put them on a permanent basis. Quote, I have been looking at the budget, and it turns out that if we continue on the same trajectory in terms of Medicare costs going up, we will never be able to balance this budget because the population is getting older and use more and more medical services. We're going to have to control these costs. We're going to have to cut. The reactionary nature of the entire health care reform enterprise, which was basically a fig leaf. Millions of elderly saw their health care being destroyed. The Obama administration proposes to finance half of the $1 trillion cost to insurance companies. The magnitude of the plot that is unfolding now is disclosed in his interview on 60 Minutes. They have plans to cut spending on Social Security and Medicare. In an olive branch to large business, Obama stated that, quote, I will work with Wall Street in implementing a financial reform bill and a realistic cut in costs on health care. It is entirely legitimate that the banking sector should know that how things are going to work. We will work with them. In other words, brothers and sisters, the financial swindlers who received almost $24 trillion have wrecked the U.S. and world economy are going to receive even more concessions from the Obama regime. He has embraced spending cuts and tax breaks for the wealthy on the 8th of November. He declared that we are going to make sure that this economy works, and he translated that into supporting those who create the engine of growth. What does he mean specifically by that? The big corporations and the banks. The intent is to cut federal employment. And meanwhile, brothers and sisters, the U.S. ruling class is preparing an all-out attack on Social Security. It will be led not just by the Republicans, by Barack Obama. The knives are already being sharpened for this long-awaited attack. In a provocative email to the president of the Older Women's League dated the 23rd of August, the Republican Senator Alan Simpson spilled the beans. He was appointed by Obama as co-chair of the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility, and he revealed a deep hatred of Social Security. Quote, Social Security has reached the point now where it's like a milk cow with 310 million tits, Simpson said. He blasted the retirees, maimed and sickened by work, and dependent survivors of dead workers who said, these are people who milk us to the last degree. Simpson was caught on tape berating an independent journalist who was revealing the ruthless logic behind this drive for cuts in Social Security. Jim Simpson dubbed them, quote, the lesser people who live too long. Now, brothers and sisters, his commission was established by an Obama executive order to rein in budget deficits. They're going to raise the retirement age to as high as 70. They're going to cut benefits for cost of living increases. And these are the plans in place by Obama and his Republican instruments. That's why Robert Reich, on October 8th, wrote a piece called The Secret Big Money Takeover of America. He writes, not only is income and wealth in America more concentrated in fewer hands than it has been in 80 years, but these hands have barred our democracy. Hundreds of billions of secret dollars are pouring into all political races. The Koch brothers, whose personal fortune grew by $5 billion last year, are behind some of it. But no one knows for sure where the flood of money is coming from because it's all secret. You can safely assume its purpose is to pad the nests of the rich, stop all reform, deregulate big corporations and Wall Street, already more powerful than since the late 19th century, when the lackeys of the robber barons deposited sacks of cash on the desks of their dependent legislators. This is language, Maya, from a former satrap of the Democratic Party, Robert Reich.
Ralph, not only a satrap of the Democratic Party under President Bill Clinton, but Bill Clinton only came into office because of deals with the super rich. It was a deal with the super rich that allowed him to have the money to enter in New Hampshire. And well, it was his deals with Dwayne Andreas of Archer Daniels Midlands that kept his campaign going. And it is under Bill Clinton that the Depression-era law that separated investment banking and consumer banking, and commercial banking, separated them. It was Bill Clinton who eliminated that law and created the travesty of the banking industry.
All true, Maya, but that's why the evidence against interest that comes from Robert Reich owning up Income and wealth has moved to the top. It's impossible to enclose, he writes, the absurd tax holes that allow hedge fund and private equity managers to treat their income as capital gains. The hedge fund managers earned an average of $1 billion last year. It is impossible to stop the extension of Bush's tax cuts. And indeed, he says that the Democratic Party is colluding in this. He is breaking ranks to the extent that he is, if you like, blowing the cover of the people he worked for a very long time.
Ralph, I would like to close our show today with a survey, a poll that was done by the Washington Post and appeared October 28th, because this poll shows that people in the United States actually agree on more than they disagree. The problem, I've always said, is how you pose the question. We can build a party of working people. It is possible to break from the Democratic Party. Working people can break and create parties in their own interest. This survey, this poll by the Washington Post, reported that 53% of American people are seriously worried about being able to make their next mortgage or rent payment. The figure rises to 75% among African Americans. And then they ask the question, would you support an immediate moratorium on home foreclosures? Now, this is a move against the banks, against the finance interests. And 65% of Americans polled by the Washington Post said yes. I'm sure if you asked the same questions about health care, do you deserve public education, the answers would be overwhelmingly, resoundingly yes.
It reflects the fact, brothers and sisters, that 41 million fewer people participated in this election than in the last. 41 million were refusing to support the Democrats they had previously supported. This is not a, quote, move to the right. This is a reflection on the part of the disillusioned many who have seen what has happened. They've been soft soaped during election time and sold out. One last point. The former BIS advisor and central banker, William White, in an interview with Dow Jones, has warned, quote, the entire world is on the verge of another collapse and a bubble that will burst with disastrous consequences. The same expression from Fortune magazine, Keith McCullough, is this finally the economic collapse? The Great Depression is unfolding on a scale, and the economist Joseph Stiglitz warned with no end in sight in the Sunday Telegraph that the crisis is only beginning to unfold. Brothers and sisters, the struggle will continue, believe me. The money power will be challenged by the masses of our people. We have to prepare for that struggle. We have to organize for that struggle with a clean break with the parties of capital. That has been the mission. That has been the vision of Taking Aim. Taking Aim and Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen will continue in that effort wherever we hear the support we are experiencing over these many years continuing. You will have us at your side, brothers and sisters.
We want to close our show with our heartfelt thanks to all of you who made Taking Aim possible. We have a long list, but especially we need to thank Mark Bilk, our webmaster, Bradley Wiedmeyer, our comrade and friend, and Michael Yoshida, the chief engineer at KPFA, who facilitated our recording each and every week.
Our devoted supporters in the tri-state area, especially our beloved Lynn Stewart and Ralph Pointer, Michael Bernzweig, Carol Brown, Gerald Chavez, Cali Fasto, Father Lawrence Lucas, Marilyn Vogt Downey, and amongst the many in prison, Tafwa Balogun and Lucas Sumler.
And the listeners around the world who listen to us each week, but particularly Nasheed Abdul-Halk in Houston, Texas, Bill Burton in Stone Mountain, Georgia, Seymour Kellerman in Cambridge, Mass., Richard Leonard in Durham, North Carolina, and Jim Stark in Great Barrington, Massachusetts.
And many people at WBAI over the years, notably Elambe Brath, Kathy Davis, Michael G. Haskins, our inveterate engineer, Indra Hardot, Max Schmidt, Jennifer Sindab, and our brother, Bernard White.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Thank you all. Tatanta, Tilapado, Tatanta, Philon, Dokmi, Walanga, May.